You are listening to the Punk News Podcast. We are still in freestyle mode because I am back. This is Features Editor John Gentile, and I am back in black and back from Vegas. And we're going to talk about that. And then next week, I actually will finally have some free time after like 3 to 4 months of no, like literally every minute being budgeted in my week. Not every minute, but almost. And so next week, I'm finally going to get the back. I think it's like 8 episodes back in the chamber, but this is a freestyle episode. Again, so Em and I are just going to talk about my Vegas adventures, and we're going to talk about some stuff. And we're going to post this right now after I'm done, no music, just to keep you guys getting some new stuff. And then we'll get the old stuff up and loaded. We spent so much time getting ready for 350, and then I'm taking forever to get – not 350, 650.
650.
And then I'm taking forever to get uploaded. But Em, what's happening? What's going on?
Ooh, actually, this was cool. There is a trend on social media that was, what's a perfect album that came out when you were 16? So I was like, shit, I don't know. So I was like, when would I have been 16? And that would have been in like
last year,
2015. Yeah. I am a teenager. But that would have been in 2015. So I'm like, what came out in 2015? And I was going through like old magazines because I have a bunch of Kerrangs, because one of the bookstores used to sell them, so like we'd drive like 45 minutes, and I get one, and it would be like the highlight of my year kind of thing. They don't do that anymore, which sucks, because like those magazines were great.
Honestly, like
I love them.
The loss of music, I mean, there still actually are a lot of British music magazines. Kerrang's British, though, isn't it? But a lot of the Brit, like, there are a lot of British music magazines still, but they're kind of chewing gum. Like I really have to say, North American music magazines are the best in the world. They're better than the British ones, and even like German ones, stuff like that. And that, like, they're kind of more in the Esquire sense, and that they kind of dig in deeper and aren't just, and this happened, and this happened. You know what I mean? It really, and less gossipy. It's more hard hitting, if you will. Go ahead, Ed. I'm sorry.
Oh no, 100%. Like, there's so many like absolutely like killer like Canadian and like American and stuff, like so good. But yeah, I was going through those because it was like, I want to know, right? And then I came across the Faith No More cover, and I'm like, oh my god, this is it. This is Sol Invictus. Because I read that the cover interview that they did for Kerrang back in like 2015 or whatever, promoting Sol Invictus. They have like the gimp on the front and in the thing, and at that point, I knew probably like 2 songs by Faith No More. That interview got me really like interested in them. And that's one of the interviews that got me interested in like doing music journalism and stuff like that. The other one was the Laura Jane Grace Rolling Stone interview. So I was like, oh my God, like, you know, kind of going down memory lane. And it's like that album is my like perfect album from when I was 16, and it was just so cool because it's, I listen to that so often. Like, I fall into like listening patterns where I have maybe like, I don't know, I have a handful of like comfort albums kind of thing. That's one of them. An album we're going to talk about later on the podcast is also one, so I'm excited to talk about that too. But I was just so surprised. I was like, oh my God, I didn't realize that came out like when I was 16. Oh my God. You know, so that was really cool. Got to kind of do a walk down memory lane, and I found the CD, and the cover feels really nice still. It's great. So that was really fun. Do you have a like a perfect album from when you were 16?
Yeah, I'll name a couple. I was Googling them as you were talking about that. Yeah. Definitely Choking Victim, No Gods, No Managers. Mind-blowing record. Perfect all the way through, and created an entire genre for sure. Definitely an amazing record. Life and Crimes of Alice Cooper, which is a box set, but it's one of the best box sets ever. And that it's got a lot of hits, but it's got a lot of very interesting rarities, and it pretty much just whips all the way through. Let's see what else here. The Maggot by the Melvins. That's Melvins doing one of their more experimental periods for sure. I mean, I'm sure there's lots I'm missing. Oh, here's another. Here's another one that I'm missing is Guar's We Kill Everything, which is actually a terrible album and probably their worst album, but it's the first Guar album that I ever got. And I loved Guar from the second I heard that record or CD. And so for me, it's a perfect record in that it's like what opened the universe of Guar to me. And plus, from there, I only had to up to go. Like, there's no, you know, like if you love their worst album, you're really going to love the ones that are better than that. You know what I mean? So, and Beastie Boys released the Sounds of Science compilation, definitely one of the best compilations ever. And I'm sure there's a whole lot of other punk ones that aren't listed, like in these bigger lists that I'm forgetting about. So all those picks. So anyways, M, I'm back from Las Vegas, and I'm just
going to welcome back.
Thank you. Vegas is always awesome. I'll just do a quick recap, and then if I'm getting boring, let me know. I flew on American Airlines, and I was the last seat on the last row, and by the bathroom, and it was a 4-hour flight or four and a half hour flight to Phoenix, and then I had like an hour from Phoenix to Las Vegas, and I don't know why so many people had to take dumps on a 4-hour flight, but like people were taking dumps nonstop, and like the door would open and it would waft out and it would smell atrocious. And not only did it smell atrocious, I'm not trying to gross you out, like every time someone would take a dump, it was like a different atrocious smell, and it was bad. At first I'm like, oh my god, what's that horrible smell? And I was sitting next to this lady to the right of me, like, oh man, I hope she doesn't think I'm like farting, because I'm totally not. And so she was like covering her face with her shirt, and I didn't blame her. So I did to kind of prove that it wasn't me. And actually, like you don't want to breathe it. Like I don't want to get too gross. I hate gross out humor. But when you smell like people's bad bathrooms, you're literally breathing in their fecal matter, which is really gross when you think about it. You know,
it is.
And then the person in front of me takes out a sandwich, and they're like a stinky, not tuna fish sandwich, like seafood sandwich. And I'm like, hey, how is anyone eating with this smell? And then so I'm getting bombarded with like nasty old seafood sandwich, and like just 20, but maybe like 15 people just taking the most wretched shits you'd ever experience. I'm like, oh my god, this is brutal, you know. And then I got to make a changeover, and I got like 15 minutes to get off the plane to get to my changeover. And I'm laying in the back, and you know how people, like, it's maddening on planes, and like, you should be like, when people in front of you are getting off the plane, get your stuff then and get situated then, so you can just hop in the lane and zoom on out, you know. But people do that thing where they step in the lane, they look around, they comb their hair, they reach up and they pull their luggage down, they put on their scarf. Oh, but it's not on right. I gotta shift my scarf. Where's my jacket? You know, I'm like, just grab your shit and get off the plane. You can adjust yourself. Like I gotta make my. Like, I wanted to punch people in the back of the head. It's mad. I'm always maddened by this. And it's just like, people really just are thoughtless schmucks. And then I'm finally like walking up the ramp, and people are just kind of waddling and taking their time. And it's like, and they got like a blockade of like just waddlers. I'm like, come on, people, just give me a little opening here so I can get to my plane, you know? So I barely make it with like 3 or 4 minutes to go.
Oh, no, and that's so close.
I get into Las Vegas, and then, you know, the flight was cool. Then I go to Hertz rental car. And so, first of all, man, like, you know, rental cars are hit or miss, man, because sometimes the people are like real nice and sometimes they're just jerks. So I go up to the lady, and she's like, license. I'm like, all right, let me, here you go. And I used to kind of get gruff with people, but now when people are rude to me, I become weirdly nice. And I'm like, how are you doing today? You know what I mean? To avoid escalating the situation, but also to be kind of annoying. You know what I mean? Because if you're trying to be tough or mean or nasty, and someone's like, have a great day, like, that's annoying too. But like, it's hard to strike back against that. You know what I mean? Whereas if I just say F you, then they ask and say, no, F you, you know? So the lady's like, insurance is $29.95 per day. I'm like, oh, I got it off Expedia for $10. She's like, that's a third party. I'm like, damn. You know, I'm like, well, I'll just stick with the Expedia. She's like, well, if you get an accident, you got to do it through your insurance. I'm like, all right, I'll take the risk, you know. And then she's like, well, you, and actually, Hertz does have this really cool option. I think Enterprise does too. They call it the manager special. And basically what it is you come to the lot and whatever they have left over, they give you, which often is better than some of the more expensive options, because people usually reserve the cheapest car, right? Meaning sometimes the medium cars aren't reserved, so you get a medium car for cheaper than the cheap car. And like I said multiple times on the podcast, the first time I went to Punk Rock Bowling was one of the best weeks I ever had. I went there and I had the, we'll give you whatever we have on hand, you know. And so I go up to the, and the guy says, what car do you want? And I pointed at this macked out Dodge Charger. I'm like, how about that one? And I was joking, and he was like, fine. I'm like, so I paid like $29.95 for like this souped up Dodge Charger, which was rad. This never happened again. But anyways, so she's like, well, the car you're gonna have is really small. I'm like, well, what? She's like, a Kia Volt or something. And I'm like, eh. I Google to see how small it is. I'm like, you know, I'll just, you know, I mean, I'm not in Las Vegas to be driving around in a Cadillac. You know, I'm just, yeah. You know, way to get it. So I'm like, I'll take whatever you got, you know. So she's like, fine, you know. And so then and I go up there. And so the way rental cars work now, or at least most of them, Hertz, is you don't even talk to anybody anymore. They say, like, go to, like, lane three or go to lane one. And you go to lane three and you see the car you want and you just open the door and take the key and drive to the exit and then they check you out, you know?
Oh, cool.
So nice. I go there and there's two cars and there's a bunch of, like, people kind of standing around with, like, this weird look on their face, you know? And I'm like, oh, I'm like, I don't know what these people are doing. I'm just going to get a car. So there's two cars. If I hop in the car, and this guy comes over, he's like not yelling but speaking loudly, and I realize, mm-hmm. Oh, they must be like waiting in line, you know, there's cars here. I'm like, well, maybe they don't know that you're supposed to just hop in a car, because that's how, you know what I mean. And yeah. Then one of the workers like just walks by me, not even looking at me, no keys. I'm like, I don't know what that means. I'm like, is he saying that like they're looking for the keys, or that these cars don't need? I like, I don't know what he's saying, you know. And then this guy, I don't know if the guy was from like Louisiana or Texas. He's like, we're all waiting for cars, and these can't go. And then I realized is that these two cars must not have keys in them. You know what I mean? Like they must have lost the keys or something. So these people are waiting in line. I'm like, oh, or like I don't know, but I'm guessing it. Then he like, you know how like windshield wipers, like you can bend them upwards. You know, when you're cleaning your windshield.
Mm-hmm.
So he starts bending the windshield wipers up on these two cars, and I'm like, what? Like is this guy like so enraged he's gonna like start ripping off windshield wipers? Like it was weird, you know what I mean? Like I'm like, what is this guy doing? So I say to them, oh, are you guys in line? And they say like yes. And so I'm standing there, I'm like, well, maybe they don't know they're supposed to like I'm still not exactly what's going on. So I see this guy walking by, and I say an employee, I'm like, so like are we waiting for the cars to come around? And the guy's like, they're washing. And I'm like, well, you know, and like the employees, like, instead of saying, hello, sir, we're behind and we're waiting for cars to come in, we're watching them, we'll be with you momentarily. They're giving me like these one word answers, like walking around. Like, people were, have you ever been in a situation where like everyone's acting weird except you? You know what I mean?
Oh, 100%.
It's so, like everyone's acting like really bizarre. Then the lady in the front of the line, she sits on the hood of a car and she's got on this big weird floppy hat. And anytime someone's in a weird hat, you know, it's not a good scene. You know what I mean?
Trouble.
And she whips out this huge sandwich and starts eating a sandwich while sitting on the hood of a car. And I'm like, I'm thinking to myself, is this the time to eat a sandwich? You know, I'm like, what is going on? You know, and so then the Louisiana guy, he's like, well, I'm just going to cancel. And he's like yelling at the guy, I want to cancel. How do I cancel? And I'm thinking, well, that's great for me because that moves me up further in the line, you know. Then this family of Chinese people, the reason I say Chinese people is because they were from China and couldn't speak English or barely spoke English. They got like five kids. They like start getting in one of the cars and I'm like, oh, there's a line. Sorry. And I somehow communicate to them that there's a line, and their kids are like running around. One of the kids like ran in front of a moving car. I'm like, holy shit, man! So like, it's like a really weird scene. And the guy and the Louisiana guy is getting madder and madder. He's like, I'm going to cancel, you know. And then all of a sudden, a car came up, and then the floppy hat lady got in, and then another car came, and then I hopped. It was like a weird like. Like the guy was getting, I'm like, I'm on vacation mostly. I'm kind of there for work too. But like, man, like,
yeah.
Like, I honestly, I get that rental cars, like, the employees were acting real weird and were doing a terrible job. But, like, man, it's like you're harshing my mellow, man. you know what I mean? So anyway, I get my car, go right to In-N-Out Burger. In-N-Out Burger is totally kick-ass. I love In-N-Out Burger. Then I go to one of the two Zia Records. Zia Records is a chain in Las Vegas. I think it might be one in other places too. But if you've ever been to Rasputin or Streetlight, it's like Rasputin or Streetlight, or it's like a mini Amoeba Records. They got a ton of new vinyl. If you want new vinyl, they got a ton of it for pretty good prices. They've got some used vinyl, a little pricey, and they've got a ton of CDs for good prices. So I got a bunch of stuff there, including some actually limited edition Dwarfs color vinyl, which is only made for Zia Records. And the cool thing about Zia Records, they have a lot of like Zia Records only vinyl like color, which was kind of cool. Then I went to my hotel, which was Circus. I usually stay at El Cortez, but El Cortez was booked solid for that day. Circus Ooh. Circus. It's giant. It's oh, but I go to Circus Circus. It's a, and it's like 2 hours to check in because there's like 200 people in line. I'm like, what is going
Holy
on?
Holy shit!
I think it was some kind of race car event or a football game or something like that. I'm like, damn, man. So anyways, I get up into my room. Circus Circus is fine. It's massive, but it's, it's fine. And so then I go down to and one of the main reasons I went out is because the Dwarves were playing a show at a place called the Dive Bar in Las Vegas, and DFL were playing, and like four other bands were playing, and the Co-Defendants were playing as well. So I go to the place. Actually, I meet up with Monty of DFL, and we go get dinner at Evil Knievel Pizza, which is on Fremont Street, which is the old strip. I just so many good places in Vegas. I would probably get pizza because Philly's got the best pizza in the world. But from Monty's perspective, in California has some of the worst pizza in the world. So I can understand how he would want significantly better pizza. And so anyway, Evil Knievel Pizza is called Evil Pie. It's pretty good. We get that. Then we go to the Dive Bar in Vegas, which is a really weird, like the Vegas punk scene is honestly one of the weirder punk scenes I've seen. So the Dive Bar it's in a strip mall. To the left is a T-Mobile and to the right is a pharmacy. And it looks like it used to be like, you know, a Walgreens or something. But like the one wall is all glass, like a strip mall. And then you go in and it is like the most wrecked bar you've ever seen. Not the most wrecked, but it's like it is a dive bar. It's pretty shitty. There's graffiti all over. It's sticky. It smells bad. The toilets are all jacked up and nasty. And it's like so weird to have like this in the middle of a strip mall, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And so anyways, the Vegas punk scene, I will say it's one of the rougher punk scenes in that like there's a lot of old drunk punks. A lot of punks there just to get blitzed. Not quite as maximum rock and roll or artsy as the Philly scene. Not quite as hip as the LA scene. And not quite as much more morally right as the Gilman scene. You know, just kind of a drunk punk scene. So if that's your style, there was like two or three people that drank so much they were just lying on the sidewalk, totally wrecked. And the scene was kind of weird because it was also like it was like 10 years or some tattoo thing. So there was a tattoo truck and a food truck there. So people were like hanging around outside and drinking. And I'm like, oh man, this is going to get shut down in 2 seconds. But I guess in Vegas, they don't care. Or maybe you're allowed to drink in public in Vegas and they just don't care. Like it was a, it was a weird scene, man. And so anyways, and Co-Defendants were playing and Fat Mike was there and he had all his pals hanging around him. And so a bunch of bands played, and honestly, I kind of hung out outside and talked to some people that I knew and instead of going in and watching them. Because I'm not trying to dig. It was kind of like your standard drunk punk bands, you know what I mean? Then DFL played. DFL was awesome. They played a bunch of new stuff and some classic stuff. They were awesome. Dwarves came out. Dwarves played some new stuff, and they were just totally awesome. Dwarves rocked. And then it was one of these things where it was pretty late. It was like, it was 2 a.m. rather, but 1 a.m. due to daylight savings. And it was kind of one of those things where like, there's no, like Co-Defendants actually played after Dwarves. And it was kind of like Adam White used to describe this in Canada. It's like, generally speaking in America, especially in the West Coast and East Coast, like the headliner is the last band and it's the grand finale. And that's the end of the show. Yeah. Whereas Vegas kind of has the thing is, the Dwarves were the headliner, but then Co-Defendants played. And so instead of the show ending with a bang, it kind of peters out as people get drunker and drunker and tireder and tireder. So it was kind of, it was a weird event for sure. So I got back to my hotel and I crashed out. The next day I went back to In-N-Out Burger. Then I went to the other Zia Records, which was totally rad. Then I'm trying to remember I went to another record store and the next, I did something else. I can't remember what I did. Then I went to the Punk Rock Museum. Punk Rock Museum's pretty cool. They've got a lot of artifacts, a lot of cool stuff. It's two levels. The bottom level has a lot of rooms. The top level has a couple of rooms. The bottom has got a bunch of old flyers. It's got some record acetates. It's got some leather jackets. It's very much similar to the Rock Museum in that basically it's a collection of artifacts, you know, jackets, records, shirts. It was pretty cool to see like promotional Clash posters from like London Calling, that kind of a thing, as well as like a lot of like early LA stuff. And it's kind of organized in like New York, LA, San Francisco. It was cool to see some like rare Dead Kennedy stuff. I think my comment would be though, is I like I think they could have done a better job explaining why certain things are important or special. You know what I mean? It's sort of like if you just went over someone's house and they had a bunch of cool stuff and they just pulled it out and you're like looking through it, you know? Whereas like when I went to the Rijksmuseum in Netherlands, it was so great that like I don't know a whole lot about art. And then when you see Rembrandt, it's so impressive to see Rembrandt. And then they say the reason Rembrandt's important is look at this other painting before Rembrandt. The guy's just standing there. But in Rembrandt's picture, the guy's running or he's jumping or he's dancing. And so Rembrandt, not only in addition to mastering light, he also put action scenes in his paintings, and that hadn't been done before, you know? And so you're like, wow, now that it's been explained to me, I do see why Rembrandt is so special. You know what I mean? Whereas I think the Punk Museum could have explained like why this item is important, you know? Though it was cool to see some Adams, Monty of DFL's band, in the early late 70s, early 80s stuff there. There was a bunch of really cool first wave Misfit stuff there. There was some cool Jello stuff there, some cool Dwarf stuff, a lot of cool stuff. So if you're out there, you definitely should go. I didn't get a guided tour, but Monkey of the Attics did a guided tour, and I overheard some stuff. It honestly seemed pretty cool. And then he walks you around and tells you about stuff, but he also like gives you some inside info, and you can ask some questions. So I mean, it seemed pretty cool, honestly. Next day, I went to give me a second, a couple different record stores, and then we'll wrap up this segment. I went to. Let's see, I didn't go to that one. How do you like that? Oh, that's because they're only open on Wednesdays. I went to Moon. No, I'm sorry. Oh, well, I did go to 11th Street Records, which is on Fremont. Oh, and of course, I checked into El Cortez, greatest hotel in Las Vegas. It's awesome. The rooms are so nice. It's extremely cheap, and it's rad and it's cool. Although, honestly, Em, as much complimenting as I do of El Cortez, and I've been there like
Yes.
four times now. I'm kind of expecting them to say, "Welcome back, Mr. Gentile. Good to see you." They kind of just treat me like I want special treatment, man. I want special treatment. It's Las Vegas. I want to be pampered. I want to be like, "Mr. Gentile, your room will be ready right away. We're so pleased to have you back here." And then they give a shit, man. I was like, "Oh, I love coming. This is my favorite hotel." And they're like, "Oh, that's great." You know, they didn't give me any special treatment whatsoever, and I wanted special treatment. So
You should send them all the podcasts where you talk about them.
I should. Oh, so anyway, so I went to Wax Trax Records in Las Vegas, and it's kind of a famous place. And it is at once the greatest record store of all time, the very greatest record store of all time, and the absolute worst record store of all time.
Oh,
And here's why.
how? Yeah.
It's run by this dude. He's been he like I walk in and I. You know, I mean, I go to a lot of record stores, and you know, I love looking at records. I walk in on a mission, like I'm here to battle, baby. You know, I walk in, I open the door, whoosh, 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 you know, punk, whoosh, 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 hip hop, whoosh, 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 bing, bing, whoosh, whoosh, bing, whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. You know, like I'm there to rock, you know. And I walk in, and the guy's like, slow down. The guy's like, slow down there. Let me tell you about the store. I'm like, all right, man, all right. You know, I'm like, I want to look, you know. And he's like, we do things a little differently here. He's like, and oh, so I walk in, and the store is without question the most cramped store I've ever been in. It's three
Ooh.
stories,
Okay.
and there are literally records from floor to ceiling. There's records in boxes on the floor. There's CDs all over. There's memorabilia all over. There's posters all over, and like literally, like normally, like there'd be like a aisle, right? But the aisle is so packed with spare records. You can't turn around, so you can't even really see those records. And there's like a bunch of records on the ground, the CDs. And I want to get on my hands and knees so I can go through those records, but I literally can't get down. It's so cramped that like my shins are touching records and my calves are touching records. You see what I'm saying?
Oh my God,
Like
okay.
the aisle is like less than a foot wide, like every
Ooh.
aisle. And plus, like the stairs have all these like little characters and memorabilia on them, and I'm thinking this is a personal injury attorney's dream. Like the stairs have just like random crap. You know, you take one misstep, you're taking a tumble. You know what I mean? Like for real, you know. And so I and honestly, like sometimes it's cool when record store has like lots of stuff you got to go through, but it's like too much. Like you can't pick something up and sort through it because there's no place to put it. You know what I mean? And so anyway, I go and the first thing I see Sam, M is a Sam Hain Unholy Passion original press. Then I see a bunch of original press
Oh,
Metallica. It's not that I care about Metallica, you know. Then I see a bunch of original Smiths, like all these like really cool records, you know. And the guy's like, "Well, let me tell you about the store. We've been here since 1962, and blah, blah. Where are you from? I'm like, I'm from Philadelphia. Like, do you know like 78th and Blues Jazz Records? I'm like, no. He's like, that's a good record. Meanwhile, store's been closed for like 45 years. You know what I mean? But you know, I'm trying to be nice. I'm like, yeah. Oh, you know Sit and Spin Records? Like, I haven't been there in a while. And he's telling me I've been collecting records for 60 years. I'm like, all right. I'm like, so I say, well, and he keeps talking, and I look at the records. Not a single record is priced, you know? And I'm like, well, how much of the Sam Hain record? He's like, well, pick out four or five records and we'll look them up for you. And I'm like, oh, this is not going to go well. Because I'm getting the gist. You know what I mean, Sam? I mean, M. So I pull out the Sam Hain record. And so I pull out the Sam Hain record. I pull out two Smiths records. I pull out a Psychic TV record. And like crazy good records. Crazy good records, you know? And I pull out like one test record. I'm trying to remember what it was. It was I'm trying to remember. I don't want to bore you all. Rolling Stones Tattoo You. You know what I mean? Because Rolling Stones Tattoo You, $6 to $10. New York City, $20. That's you know, but, you know, pretty much anywhere else, $6 to $10, maybe 12, you know? Yeah. And so I hand them to him, you know, and I'm like, so what do you want for these? He's like, well, we got to look them up. I'm like, oh, I'll just look around, I guess. So I'm looking around for 10 minutes. I came across a Psychic TV record and some other cool records. And I'm like, wow. I'm like, you know, he's got like First Press Germ records, and it's not all punk, mind you. He's got like Bing. Oh, and he's got a $5. But I'm going through. He's like, well, I don't think you're gonna find any Misfits records there. I'm like, yeah. I'm like, I'm looking for everything from Sinatra to Misfits to Psychic TV to Pink Floyd to whatever, you know, to Peter Tosh. He's like, oh, okay, well, you'll have fun going through there. Meanwhile, the $5 bin is a dollar bin, but it's a $5 bin. Not even really, you know what I mean? I'm like, ugh, you know. So then I go through the other records, and like, I guess the one of the many nicer sections, and he's got Suburban Lawns. I'm like, wow, you know, I already have it, but I'm like, oh, that's cool, man. And he's got like Black Flag Damage with Anti-Parent Sticker. You know, he's got like all these like hard hitter records. I'm like, but I don't want to start pulling them off the shelf and like waste everybody's time, you know. So I point to a Thin Lizzy record, Jailbreak, $20 record. I'm like, well, what do you want for that record? You know, I'm just trying to gauge where we're at, you know? And he's like, well, we got to look it up. I'm like, oh, my God. I'm like, and I'm thinking, you should know what Thin Lizzy Jailbreak costs. $20. $10 if you're cheap, $30 if you're expensive. You know, I'm like, this is not – so I'm like, well, where are we at? Is it gone? 15 minutes goes by. And he's like, we only looked up two. And I'm like, what is – take? Like, I could look up these records in like 3 minutes. I'm like, what is taking these dudes, you know? So yeah. Anyway, I go upstairs and upstairs is the rock section, and he's got 20 copies of every Rolling Stones record, 20 copies of every Pink Floyd record, but he's also got like Nirvana First Press. He's got every Iron Maiden record First Press, every Judas Priest record First Press. But oh, he's got like 5 copies of the of Cramp's Bad Music for Bad People. I'm like, who has 5 copies of this? You know what I mean? I'm like, holy shit, man. Like, he's got he's without question, he's got the most amazing collection of records I've ever seen at a record store in one place. You know what I mean? Like, you go to Amoeba, and Amoeba has awesome stuff, but it's going to fly off the shelf. You know what I mean? You go to Sit and Spin. Sit and Spin's getting in amazing stuff all the time. But they get it in, bang, it's gone in a day, not even. You can go to Double Decker Records. You can go to Revilla Groove Records. They get in incredible stuff, but it's gone. Like, they put on Instagram, it's gone that day. You know what I mean? And I'm like, how does this guy have all these freaking amazing records? And I know how. I mean... Why do you think he has them, man? Just out of guess, why do you think?
Record swaps.
Well, I mean, but why are they all there, and why are they not? You know, Revilla Groove Records, he'll put a Misfits Earth AD on the wall. It's gone in 2 hours, you know? Yeah. Why does this guy have 5 Misfits Earth ADs?
Come and hang out with me.
So I go down. I'm like, so where are we at, man? It's been like literally like 30 minutes. And he's like, we're still looking them up. I'm like, oh my God. Like, and there's a million records I want to pull off the shelves and buy, but I don't know what the value is. And I don't want to pull off like 50 records, you know, and you know, we're way too high. So I go downstairs. I'm looking at the reggae records. And so after about 40 minutes, I go back up and I'm like, so where are we at? And he goes, slow down there. I'm like, oh my God, dude, you know? And he's like, so what we do is we look up the value online, and then we decrease it about 15%. I'm like, all right, you know. And so he pulled out, I got the 10-inch version of Smith's Rank. And he says, this goes for $130 online, but we'll sell it for $100. And do you know what? Oh, actually, no, I'm sorry. I forgot one thing. While I'm waiting for them to do the final tally, and they got to write it all on a piece of paper, you know what I mean? Like Jesus, you know, this guy comes in, and he's like, hey, you want to buy my records? And this is a common thing in Las Vegas. And the guy's like, I'll give you $1 for the box. And he's like, I've got AC/DC here, Rush. I've got Sade. Those are $80 records, which they're not, you know, but yeah. he's like, well, I've got a bunch of them. No one buys Rush anymore. No one buys AC/DC. And that's not true at all. Like AC/DC buys off the shelves, Rush right now for some, whatever it is. I'm like, this guy's insane. So the guy says, well, I'm not going to sell them for like $2 or whatever. So then he's going outside. I'm like, let me get that door for you. I mean, hey man, if you want to hang around 10 minutes, I might make it off. So, which is a total dirtbag maneuver, which you shouldn't do. But you know, I'm like, this guy's like jerking me around. Screw this guy, you know what I mean? So I go back and he says, "What, you try to offer to buy those records?" I'm like, "Yeah, I did. You didn't want them." And honestly, I think I came across as too hostile.
Oh no.
So, anyways, the guy says to me, he's like, "Well, the Smiths records, the 10-inch version of Smiths Rank, which is the Smiths Live, says this goes for $130 online. But I'll sell to you for $100. And I'm like, that's $40 on Discogs, man. Like it's $130 if it's sealed and never opened from 1993, from when that copy came out. I can go online right now and buy it for $40. I'm like, this is taking – I'm like, just let me know what you want for the Sam Hain record, because I don't want to waste your time. You know what I mean? And he goes, $500. I'm like
– what?
I'm like, at best, it's a $350 record. It's a price. It ain't a $500. I'm like, all right, man, thanks a lot. And it's like – just it's Jesus. Like it's just totally like wasting my time. And then later on I went online and apparently like this is his thing, like every go Google his reviews, Wax Tracks, not Wax Tracks Chicago, Wax Tracks Las Vegas, and like everyone talks about he's got the best records ever and he doesn't want to sell any of them because they're so overvalued. It's crazy. I don't know how he makes any money, but he must, I guess. So anyways, so I go outside. And this guy, you know, Las Vegas is a sketchy town. I'm like, I don't think these are this guy's records, you know. You know what I mean? But so anyways, I'm like, well, listen, man, I'll go through them and I'll cut you. I mean, I'll tell you what, I'll throw out some numbers. Oh, and the guy says, good luck buying from that guy. He's not going to what you want to pay for him. I say, all right. So I go outside and I'm like, so I'm just going to make you some offers and you can tell me if you think that's fair. I'm like, AC/DC, $5, Sade, $5, Rush, $5, which is a little low, but not obscenely low. And the guy's like, that's fine with me. And so he like sold me all his records for like $80. But then I'm like,
oh my God.
So I had like two massive boxes of records. And I'm like, how am I going to get these on the plane? So I threw them on my rental car. And then I went to Record City. Record City's kind of cool. Not a whole lot of crazy stuff, but he did have some interesting stuff. It's definitely worthwhile checking out. And the guy says, well, where else have you? I'm like, I'm from Philly, man. I'm checking out your store. And he's like, well, where else you go? I'm like, Wax Tracks? He's like, well, how'd that go? I'm like, how do you think it went? He's like, yeah. So anyways, cool shop. I did get a cool Van Halen bootleg record there and some other kind of interesting records. Not the greatest record store, but definitely worthwhile if you're in town checking out. Then I went to this place. Actually, it was right next to the dive bar called Cash for Chaos. It's one of these punk shops that has like clothes and records and studs and everything. I was kind of bummed out because most of the clothes were bootlegs and there were some of my client bootlegs. I'm like, that's not cool, man. If you want to bootleg a band that's not around anymore, that's all right. You know, like the Scream, like no one's making Screamer shirts. So if people want Screamer shirts, fine. But like when bands are making money off their shirts and need them to survive, it's not cool to bootleg that kind of stuff. Plus the record selection wasn't that great. I mean, I would say nice things about them, but you know, I can't get on like a massive part of the business is selling bootleg shirts, which I'm always not down with. And so, let's see, then to wrap this up, the next day I went to, Moondog Records. Well, actually, first I went to 11th Street Records, which is on Fremont. Vegas record stores are compared to the East Coast and even to the West Coast, a little overpriced, but maybe that's just what records cost maybe that's just the market in Vegas. Everything did seem a little higher than the East Coast and the West Coast. But I did go to 11th Street, which is run on Fremont. And I've been there before, and honestly, it's kind of tough pickings, man. Like a lot of really, you know, pick through records, and like a lot of records like in the new stuff, but it's like Bing Crosby or some, you know, like the Richie Sisters, like, and you're like, who's buying that record now that doesn't already have that record? You know what I mean? It was kind of weird. Like, who's buying that record? You know. However, just as I said that, I'm flipping through. I come across a Chumbawamba 12-inch single I've been looking for years. Now, I could just buy it online for like $30 after shipping from the UK, but there it was for $15. I'm like, wow. So I got to say, 11th Street Records, definitely worthwhile hitting up because you might hit something really cool. So it was totally rad. And so anyways, let's see. Then I went to Moondog Records, which was kind of cool. Actually, Moondog Records has got a lot of records and a lot of cool records. You know, a little overpriced on some records, but very, very reasonably priced on some other records. I bought a good amount of records there. And also, they have a lot of really interesting things. They've got a Japanese import section, so European and North American bands printed in Japan. They've got a massive Madonna section if you're into rare Madonna records. They got a pretty cool hip hop section, a pretty cool punk section, a pretty cool metal section, and a lot of cool rock records. So a lot of really cool and interesting records that you might not see. So I got a lot of cool stuff there. Definitely worth checking out. My only criticism is that this is not cool. They sell bootleg versions of rare records, like bootleg versions of Danzig 1 and 2, bootleg version of Judas Priest's Demolition. Bootleg records of records from the 90s that are very rare because they didn't make that many records in the 90s. The problem is Danzig 1 bootleg, $30 record maybe. Original, $200, you know what I mean? Or right. Maybe even $150 on a great day. They price their bootlegs between reasonable used and cheap for bootleg. So, for example, they were selling a bootleg Danzig 4 for $80. That's not an $80 record, man. That's like a $30 record. And so a kid that doesn't know what he's doing might say, wow, it's Danzig 4, a $250 record, $300 record for $80. What a deal. That's great. And so he thinks he's getting a deal, but he's totally getting ripped off, you know? Mm-hmm. And so kind of not cool. If you're going to do that, if you're going to sell bootlegs, and I can understand you don't want to label them bootleg because that does subject you to – I mean, honestly, even selling bootlegs does subject you to liability. But if you sell bootlegs and label them bootlegs, then if you get hit with a lawsuit, it damages are going to be worse because it's clear you know you're selling bootlegs. Whereas what the workaround is, you can say put modern press. And that way, if you get hit, you can just say, I thought they were official from the distributor. I didn't know. You know what I mean? Yeah. Now, of course, anyone that knows anything about records knows there's bootlegs. But if you want to label the modern press as opposed to bootleg, that's fine. You know what I mean? But it's definitely not cool to sell modern bootlegs at wildly inflated prices that make it seem like it's a cheap original to people that don't know what they're doing. So that was kind of not cool. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Also, they had a bunch of cool CDs, but none of them are priced at all. And I'm like, well, how much are the CDs? He's like, well, we can look them up for you. And I'm like, you know what, man? I'm over it, man. I'm over it, you know? And so anyways, just before I check out, this guy comes in and he's got a box of records.
No.
And the guy says, these are too used for me. I can't use them. So he's checking me out. I see the guy like pissed off, go out to his car, and he's kind of stomping around. And I'm thinking, check me out quick, man. Come on. Let's like, and the guy's like, where are you from? And I'm like, dude, just check me out. Just ring me out. Finally, he rings me out. The guy outside's about to drive away. He's got his window cracked. I'm like, hey, man, if you want to sell those records, meet me around the corner. So we go around the corner. And this guy's definitely a drug addict, and he's got these BS records, man. But he does have like Pink Floyd, The Wall, Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. And I'm like, so what do you want, man? He's like, well, that guy didn't give me any money. I'm like, well, you tell me what you want. He's like, I'll sell you the whole box for $30. I'm like, well, how about I just pull what I want for $20, and then maybe you can sell the other record somewhere else. He's like, that's fine. So I pulled out, you know, some good snatches for $20, and I gave him the $20, and he drove away with a bunch of stuff.
I
was a total dirtbag in Las Vegas. But on the other hand, man, like they said, no, you know, what you definitely should not do ever, ever, ever is don't swipe in before they've had the chance to buy them. Buying them after the other guy doesn't want them, still kind of a dirtbag. And I definitely wouldn't do that in record stores that I visit frequently. You know what I mean? But you know what, Em? I did feel that the record store guys were being kind of dicks. So I'm like, well, you know what, man? You know, they didn't want it, you know? So then I go back to my hotel. I go to In-N-Out Burger again. Go back to my hotel. And then I'm like, oh, my God. I got all these records, man. So I'm trying to pack up to get just under 50 pounds in my suitcase. I put a whole bunch of stuff in my backpack. And Zia Records gave me a bag. And honestly, I hate people that, like, you're supposed to have one carry-on and one personal item. And the personal item is supposed to be a computer bag or a pocketbook, or that's it. You know what I mean? But anymore, people bring like two massive suitcases with them. Oh, one's my person, one's my carry-on. And I hate those people. I'm like, oh man, I'm going to be that dirtbag, you know? And in my big suitcase, I jammed in so many. I'm like, oh man, I think he's over 50 pounds. So I took some out, right?
Yeah.
Then in my carry-on, I jammed it, because your carry-on can be whatever weight you want it to be, you know, as long as it fits, you know.
Oh, fair enough, yeah.
I jammed these records so tight into the suitcase, if you sneezed on it, it would explode. And then I've got my carry-on, which is my ZU Records bag, and I'm trying to like cram it down to make it look smaller, you know. Then, yeah. So I'm checking out the next morning. So then I go and see David Copperfield. And David Copperfield was amazing. I mean, it was so amazing.
Oh, nice.
Anyone in Las Vegas should go see David Copperfield. So the crappy seats were $70. And what do you think the best seats were?
Crappiest were $70. I'm going to say $200.
Only $120.
Oh, that's very fair.
So I'm like, screw it. I'm going to get the best seats there are. I was literally right up against the stage. And it was pretty cool. So, I mean, I don't want to give away the whole thing, you know, because people should go see. It's awesome. But, like, it's like in the beginning, they bring up this big empty box. You know, like, it's like just a frame, you know. They throw a blanket over it for like a second. A motorcycle roars. They pull it off. David Copperfield is there riding a motorcycle. I'm like, wow. You know? And the whole night is just him like doing like a. The story is that he used to tell his dad that he loved him, and that he stopped doing that, and then his dad died before he could tell him that he loved him. Aww. And like that's like the theme of the story. Well, see, I thought it was a little exploitative and a little hokey. You know what I mean? Like because he's making a show out of that, you know. So, anyways, so halfway, and if you don't want to know, then skip ahead the next 5 minutes, and maybe I'll tell the grand finale me if you want to hear the grand finale or not. But sure. While he's doing that, he talks about how he used to have like this toy dinosaur T-Rex skeleton about a foot tall, and he lost the toy and he's been looking for it ever since. He's looked on eBay and he can't find it, right?
Yeah.
And so meanwhile, he does a whole bunch of tricks. Like there's one trick where he goes out in the middle. He actually does a lot of tricks in the middle of the audience, which is pretty cool. If you have crappy seats, sometimes you have great seats. You know, like, and honestly, there's not really a bad seat in the house. So he goes out in the middle, and this guy says that his sister had a bucket list and she died. And on her bucket list was wanting to kiss Johnny Depp and be part of a David Copperfield magic trick. And because she died, he wants to do everything she wanted to do. So instead of kissing Johnny Depp, he shook his hand. And so David Copperfield, and honestly, like, it did seem like that, like, I'm like, are these people playing? Oh, do you want to hear about the tricks or you don't want to hear about the tricks?
If you want to talk about the tricks, sure.
Yeah, I do, because it was so. Listen, people, if you're going to go see, skip ahead 5 or 10 minutes. It's amazing. So near the beginning of the show, he asks people around, like he throws a frisbee out into the crowd, and he says, "Now throw it again. Now throw it again." And like people were like stupefied, and he was getting angry that people weren't like throwing the frisbee or whatever. Like people just could not get the direction. Like he's getting, it's going to be a long night. He kept saying that. So like they throw it like three times, and then somebody grabs it, and he says. And he says, my grandfather only had two cars in his entire life, and he always wanted a 1952 green Packer or something like that, you know. And he only had two cars his entire life. And so the frisbee's thrown around. And he says to one guy, "Give me two numbers." And the guy's like, 1 and 17. Now throw the frisbee again. Now throw it again. Now throw it again. And it comes to some other person, and he's like, "You madam, give me two numbers, 19 and 42." And he's like, "Where are you from?" And she's like, "I don't know, Alaska or something." Throw the frisbee again. They throw the frisbee again. And it comes to another guy. He says, "Give me two numbers, 6 and 12. And he's like, "What color are your boxer shorts?" And the guy's like gray. You know what I mean? And so he writes it on a piece of paper, right? I mean, on a big piece of paper in the thing, right? And he says, and everybody had to put their cell phones in a wooden box, you know, at the table. And he's like, before all that, he says, "I'm going to send an email, but don't open it till after the show." And it's 7:10 right now, okay? So then he asks all those questions, right?
Yeah.
And then he brings out a locked box that's been locked the whole time. And he brings a lot of people on stage, and he gives them keys. And he's like, "Open up the locked box." They open up the locked box, right? And they pull out a piece of paper. And the numbers that the people said are on the piece of paper in the locked box. Right.
Oh yeah, cool.
That's cool. That trick's been done before. Then he pulls out two license plates, which are the license plates of the numbers that people said that are supposed to be from his grandfather's car. Now I don't know how one. You know. Then
that's cool.
Then he like walks in the middle of the stage, and he kind of steps up on like a little platform, and he has other people hunch below the platform. They throw a sheet over everybody for a second. They whip it off. He's driving a 1957 green Packer, and everyone else like hunch under it. Like they got a car on stage like at half second.
Holy shit.
It was pretty great. Then he goes out into the middle of the stage, right? And this guy tells a story about wanting to, you know, be part of the trick. So he kind of goes up on a ladder with the guy. He covers the guy in a sheet. The sheet lifts up the ground. It's like flying around. I'm not even kidding you. Then it like spins around and is empty. Then the guy's on stage surrounded by the audience that they brought on stage. You know what I mean?
Oh, shit. Okay.
Then.
Sure.
Then David Copperfield says, and then he goes back on stage. And he's like, I recently discovered that my dad worked at Roswell in Area 51. And this is where it got kind of hokey and kind of cheesy. And I'm not saying you shouldn't go see David. Like, you definitely should go see David Copperfield because it's rad. So like, there's like a flash. And like this animatronic short alien comes out. And it looks basically like Baby Yoda, but he's like Disney-fied. And he's like talking to David Copperfield. Yeah. And he like farts a lot, which I was not a fan of. And then like David Copperfield is like he's like and like the alien is like, David, it's all about love. And like David Copperfield like hugs him, but it's not supposed to be like funny. It's supposed to be like serious. I'm like, this is kind of hokey. And everyone's like, oh, I'm like, this is kind of like, it was. I feel like I was like Seth. I don't smoke, but I feel like I was Seth Rogen high watching something. I'm like, he's like. I forget the alien's name, but it was like Bill's Yaks or something. He's like, I love you, Bill's Yaks. And then I was like, I love you too. I'm like, yeah. Like, this is a little, and it went on for like a half hour. And he did some lesser magic tricks, which was cool, you know?
Yeah.
And then, but the whole time, like, Dan's like, I want to get back to my family. And Dave's like, you know, he's like, let me show you a picture of my family. And he shows you a picture of his parents from like 1950 or something. And like, the alien's like, I miss my family. He's like, the only way we can reunite is with the power of love.
Oh, no.
And people are like, oh, I'm like trying to not crack. It's like, it's like it's this farting Yoda looking alien. I mean, the alien didn't move around and walk around. It was cool to see, but like, that's not like magic. It's like special effects, but it was cool, you know? And so then anyway, eventually like, Dave's like, everyone point at the center of the room with my heart symbol for your hands and believe in love. And everyone did it. And then like, it goes dark for like a second. And then the lights turn back on and there's a gigantic spaceship flying around the room, which was pretty cool. Like gigantic.
Oh, neat.
And I'm thinking, well, George Clinton has done this before, but it was pretty cool. And then like, spaceship like flies like through the curtains in the back. And then like the lights go black again. And like, it's a video of the alien, like getting in the spaceship and flying away, away from the MGM Grand. And then it's a picture of David Copperfield's parents, like the old picture from like 1950 or whatever.
Yeah.
And David Copperfield walks into the picture, which is not a magic trick, but it was an interesting.
Oh, that's effect, cool.
You know? So that's the end of the show, but it's not, because then he comes back out and he does some other magic tricks. I can't exactly remember what they were, but they were cool. And then he like at the grand finale, he brings out like that kind of empty box that he had before that he appeared in, you know, and it's, you know, it's like an empty cube. You can see all the way through it, right? He throws, well, his assistants throw the blanket on it for a second, then a giant version of his toy T-Rex jumps out and starts roaring at the audience. Life-size T-Rex is like roaring at the audience in like a second. It was a really, really awesome like ending. It was so cool. Then I missed a part. And before that happens, is he brings a lady on stage, he takes a blank piece of paper and he hoists it way up into the sky. You know, he says, I want you to pick a famous celebrity and write it on a piece of paper. And he's like, so where are you from and how long are you staying here? Blah, blah, blah. And then afterwards, he's like, let's see the paper. And it says, not Bruce Willis. Who was it? It was, maybe it was Bruce Willis. It was someone like that. No, it wasn't Bruce Willis. We'll just say it was Bruce. It wasn't. It was someone else.
Okay.
They pulled on the piece of paper and they turned it around. It's a picture of Bruce Willis. And the image is made by the lady, her answers are what the lines that made Bruce Willis's face.
Oh, that's cool.
And it was hanging up in the sky the whole time. Like, I don't know how the hell they did that. And then the dinosaur like jumped out, which was extremely rad. Then the show's over. You go out, you open your email. He sent the email at 7:10. He asked the people questions at 7:20, right? The email says arrived at 7:10, right? You open the email. It's a picture of him holding a piece of paper that has all the people's answers from 7:20, but the email's dated 7:10.
Oh. Nice.
It was wild. It was.
That's really cool.
Anyone should go see David Copperfield. It was really, really cool. It really was cool. Now that I've spoiled it all for you, but maybe we'll change it. I don't know. So, anyways,
You'll see a farting alien anyway.
The farting dancing alien. So the next day, you know, I go to check in, and my bag was 49 pounds, 1 pound below the weight. But meanwhile, I got my carry on my thing. So I get in the security line, right? And this lady says, "Oh, you're a record collector, huh?" I'm like, "Yep." And so, you know, I make small talk with this lady. Then I go through the thing, and I put on my I put all my stuff on the conveyor belt. And in Philadelphia, they're like, "Do not take your computer out of the bag. Do not take your computer out of the bag." But then in Las Vegas, they're like, "Take your computer out of the bag. You better take your computer out of the bag." And then I put it, like, I take my computer out of the bag. And she's like, "Put it in a separate tray, sir. Put it in a separate tray." I'm like, "All right, man." Like, whatever. So I put my stuff in the conveyor belt. Yeah. And then one of my shoes gets knocked off my tray and is on the conveyor belt itself, right? And this guy, the guy in front of me, is like, "There's a shoe in the conveyor belt. There's a shoe in the conveyor belt." And I'm thinking, like, "Don't worry about it, dude. Like, if you start acting weird, they're going to start acting weird, and it's going to cause problems." He's like, he runs over to one of the guys, like, sir, there's a shoe in the conveyor."
Oh no,
that's problem, man. And he goes to another guy, "Shoot, there's a shoe in the conveyor belt." So they hit like this big red stop button. They fish my shoe out the conveyor belt and take it back around. My things get flagged. You know what I mean?
Then
the lady behind me, she's like, "You've been flagged." She's like, "You've been flagged. Oh no." I'm like, "Lady, shut up." I didn't say anything. I'm thinking, "Lady, shut up. It's not a big deal." You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, she's getting like all worried that my stuff is flagged. I'm like, "Who are these people?" You know what I mean? And so anyways, So the guy basically takes like one peep at my bag and says, "You're good to go." All right, cool. So I go to the plane. My book bag is like 75 pounds because it's so stacked with records. And then I'm like, "Oh, damn, my carry-on looks a little too big." So I stuff more records into my bag. And so my carry-on bag really is tiny. And then I see people getting on the plane, and these people got like gigantic ass suitcases. And I'm like, "I did all this feed." You know, I got on the plane and flew back, and it was awesome. And Vegas rules for 3 days exactly. You want to go to Vegas? Go for 3 days. It's cool.
No longer, and then it rubs off, or?
Then there's not a whole lot else to do, frankly. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But Vegas is awesome. Fremont Street rules. And along those lines, then, let's get to the show. I mean, I went a little long, but let's get to the show. Is Punk Rock Bowling has been announced.
Oh, yeah.
Let me take a quick look here. Punk Rock Bowling.
Punk Rock Bowling.
Woo. Punk Rock Bowling is Memorial Day, May 24th through 27th in Vegas. Blind tickets are on sale, which means you can buy a ticket without knowing who's playing at a discount. I snatched up a ticket right away. I still wasn't quick enough to get the $150 ticket, but I did get the $160 ticket. Oh, no, actually, looks like all the blind festivals, all the blind tickets are now sold out. No.
Oh, wow, that was fast.
$100 tier still open. I think the normal price is like $250 or something. So if you do get an early ticket, you can save $100+, especially because the additional fees are percentage wise. So for every dollar you save on the ticket price, then you save it more fee wise. If that makes any sense, you know what I mean? But notably, I did that last year, and then of course last year's lineup was very ho hum. So hopefully this year the lineup will be more exciting. So we'll see, but if not, then I might just sell my ticket again. It looks like VIP tickets are still on sale for $550, but yeah. I mean the VIP is kind of I don't really reckon. All it does is mean basically you get in and out, and I guess quicker access to the bar. But is that worth like, you know, $350? Like probably. I mean, honestly, it's kind of not cool they don't do in and outs at all. You know, I mean, I actually have like a safety thing. I mean, it's a long day. It's hot. You know, And you know, that 2 hour respite can be huge, you know. If it's a band you want to see early on and they're like nothing for 4 hours, it kind of sucks that way, you know. But anyways, I already bought my ticket, and if the lineup's flaming, I'll just resell my ticket. And of course, I already booked my El Cortez stay while I was at El Cortez. They didn't care, even though I was booking while I was there. But listen, if you're going to go to Punk Rock Bowling, book your hotel now. Because in Vegas, you can always cancel like up to 48 hours in advance or even 24 hours in advance. So book your ticket now. And then if you decide not to go, then just cancel. Because hotels are based on demand. So the longer you wait, the much, much more expensive they got. Like, except for Saturday night, my hotel is only like $40 at El Cortez, which is a 5-star hotel. But if you wait like 3 months, it's going to become like $300 due to demand or more, you know. So get your hotel now. And then if you decide not to go, just cancel your hotel stay. You know. So anyways, oh, but the important thing is Last Punk Rock Bowling was moved from where it used to be, and now it's moved to it was moved to like the parking lot, which early Punk Rock Bowling was in the parking lot. Then they moved it to the Las Vegas Event Center or whatever, which is great because it's like fake grass. It's comfortable and it's got these huge tents that you can sit under. And frankly, when you're out in the sun all day long, you know, that little bit of shade is like a lifesaver. Plus you can sit down and relax. You don't have to be on your, like, you don't want to sit down on a, you know, on a parking lot with needles and bricks and shit. You know what I mean? But when you got that faux football grass, you can sit down in the shade and relax and even lie down and take a little bit of nappy nap if you want to. So, but the last Punk Rock Bowling last year was back in the parking lot. Apparently it was a shit show. Apparently it was really hot. Apparently like the toilets weren't that good. And apparently like, it was hard to get even water. So it was pretty rough. They're moving back to the Las Vegas Event Center, which is way better. And so I'm looking very much forward to Punk Rock Bowling. We'll see if the lineup matches my very high standards. And if it does, I'm definitely going to go. So that's where we're at with Punk Rock Bowling, man.
I hope the lineup matches.
We'll see.
Is a Las Vegas entertainment tax? What is that?
Any
is it a scam?
Well,
they do one in Niagara Falls, and it's basically a scam.
Well, it's a scam in that, like, it's just money paid to Vegas because Vegas wants money. You know what I mean? Like what do you mean by scam?
Well, just like, I know sometimes it's a whatever tax, but it doesn't go to the city. It doesn't go to where it's supposed to.
Oh,
it just goes to like the pockets of the people. Yeah.
Right. I believe, actually, I'm almost sure the Las Vegas entertainment tax does go to Las Vegas. It's their version of sales tax for services, which isn't usually subject to sales tax.
Fair enough.
Just because, you know, and I mean, that is kind of lame, but on the other hand, that maybe that's one of the reasons everything's so cheap in Vegas. Like, hotels are super cheap, food's super cheap, you know, so rental cars are cheap, so records are expensive. So anyways, Punk Rock Bowling is cool. I think people probably should get blind tickets, and if they don't want to go, then just sell your ticket, which I did relatively easy last year. Let's see. And let's whip through a couple other stories. Let's see here. The Chats are going on an Australian tour. And who's M? The Prize, Ghoulies, not the Groovy Ghoulies, Bond Eye Boys, The Unknowns, and Mean Jeans. And the reason Mean Jeans rules. They haven't actually put out a record in a while. It's been a long – I mean, Christian last year put out the Funky Punks in Space, which was an amazing record that no one cared about at all. You know, it was one of the best records of the year, which is weird. And do you think that record was amazing as I thought it was, or did you just like it but you didn't love it?
I liked it, but I didn't love it. But I can see, like, your praise of it because it is a very good record.
I absolutely adore that record, but no one cared. Mean Jeans are going on tour. I thought it was the end of Mean Jeans because various Mean Jeans have gotten married and have had kids. And so sometimes that is kind of the end of a band, understandably, when people get real lives as opposed to punk lives. So I'm very excited to see that Mean Jeans at least is doing some form of touring here and there. So that's very exciting.
Yeah, and they get to go to Australia.
They actually
see koalas.
Mean Jeans toured Australia with Chats before, and they toured USA with Chats, and I believe they get along really, really well. In fact, they actually released a record together where they both cover. Actually, I think they both cover AC/DC, or does Chats cover AC/DC and Mean Jeans cover? Let's see. I'm taking a look right here. No, I'm sorry. Chats cover Kiss, and Mean Jeans cover Kiss as well. Mean Jeans, hilariously, cool. Mean Jeans cover a crappier Kiss song, Crazy Crazy Nights, which is definitely, I mean, most Kiss songs are crappy, but it's cool that they do cover one of the crappier ones, which is funny. So anyways, I think they get along really well. It's a great, I've seen Mean Jeans and Chats together. It's an awesome show. Everyone should go, and I'm very excited that Mean Jeans are still somewhat active. They haven't put out an album for 4 years. Next year is going to be 5, so we'll see what happens. And
Maybe soon. Maybe. They could be playing new songs in Australia. We don't know.
Let's see, a couple other quick stories. And more. Tell us about the Beatles now and then.
Oh boy. Okay, I have a stance on this where I have refused to listen to the song. And I am not budging from refusing to listen to the song.
Why are you refusing? Because you hate the Beatles, or because you hate AI, or because you think it's cheesy?
Because it gives me the ick. I don't hate the Beatles, they are not my favorite band in the world, but you cannot deny their influence. And we wouldn't have Black Sabbath without the Beatles. So, you know, they have some good stuff, whatever. The, we have unearthed a little piece of John Lennon and we have AI'd him into this song. Just feels so wrong to me. It's like, there is a fine line between honoring somebody's memory and exploiting somebody's memory. And this just feels like we're trying too hard to do something, and we're trying too hard to maybe use new technology and whatever. I don't know. I'm just not a fan of the whole thing, and it makes me feel really, really weird, especially when they had to deal with like his estate and whatever, but I don't know. There's just something about somebody not having a say in something. And then, oh, we're going to do this because, oh, they would have loved it. Or we're going to be profitable because of this. And I'm not saying that's the Beatles' intention, but, you know, it seems very slimy to me. So, yeah. I'm not a fan of this. John, what's your take on the new Beatles?
I mostly agree with your take. What I think is interesting, not the right word, but no, worth focusing on is when this was first announced, the Beatles were like, we got a new Beatles song via AI. And everyone was like, oh, that's kind of not cool and weird and creepy. And then they kind of backtracked and they're like, well, we just used AI to separate John Lennon's voice from instruments on a John Lennon unreleased solo demo, you know? So at first they were like, AI created it. And they're like, no, actually, we just use it to kind of remove some treble and get rid of the instruments, which has been done before, not with AI, but I mean, that's done all the time, like especially in remasters and remixes. They'll use various technologies to remove backing noise from a vocal track, you know? So the question is, well, is that all they did, or are they covering their ass and they actually did kind of manufacture John Lennon's vocals from nothing, you know? And then, and then like the Beatles have been bootlegged to death. So it's like, how come no bootleg has ever heard this demo before? You know, there's so many bootleg demos of crappy John Lennon tracks. You know, how come this has never surfaced before? Now it's surfacing. It could just because it kept under lock and key, or it could be that they did generate it from the mist, and then because they got flack for doing it, they kind of backtracked. Who knows? That being said, I don't really care about defending John Lennon's legacy or say, John Lennon was kind of a great artist, kind of an asshole. Probably not quite as important as he thinks he was, you know, and not quite as talented as he was. And to prove that, you only have to compare his Beatles work with his post-Beatles work, you know. And I usually say Paul is way better than John, and Paul is way better than John because Paul's post-Beatles music is way better than John's post-Beatles music. But Paul's kind of an asshole too and kind of a phony baloney, you know what I mean? So I don't even really care anymore. I'm like, well, screw these guys. But I still like the Beatles. I thought this song was maudlin and kind of stupid and not necessary. And it was clearly put out just to sell the reissues of Beatles Blue and Beatles Red. And they've done that before. People kind of forget that when the Beatles re-released when the Beatles released Beatles Anthology in the 90s, they did make some new Beatles songs from some John Lennon demos then as well. But what I think is kind of particularly strange is these songs – John Lennon's vocals aren't Beatles vocals. They're John Lennon's solo vocals. So they're taking vocals recorded long after the Beatles and just calling it a Beatles track, which I think is kind of disingenuous.
Disingenuous.
Yeah, you know what I mean? It's like, well, it's not Beatles. It's like, if you look at it this way, if you took a Joe Strummer demo from 1995 and put Mick Jones on guitar behind it and Paul Simon in on bass behind it, is that a Clash song? Not really. It's after the era. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
But they did that before though with the anthology stuff too. So I'm pretty much very against. I am very anti AI, particularly in the arts. I think it's crappy and weird, and I give it thumbs down both and how we got here, and also the song itself, I think, is weak. And the other thing is, I'll mention this, and then we'll do one more story and wrap this up, is everyone's like, oh, Giles Martin has done such a wonderful job remixing these songs. But, like, isn't – I mean, one of the reasons the Beatles are so famous is because the original sounds so amazing. And decades, people said, George Martin, he's the master producer. He's the main reason, or one of the main reasons why the Beatles sound so great. So we're taking what is widely considered some of the best-sounding records ever, and then having the guy's son remix them and saying, oh, it's so good. It's like, but I thought it was perfect the first time around. You know, like it's just, I feel people are kind of getting caught up in a scam's not the right word. Like a
nostalgia thing?
No, like a sales pitch. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, yeah.
You know, this new, you know, a Flex Seal will, you know, clog any drain. And then you
poke
get
your
it.
Boat with it.
And you get it, and it's not that great, but people think it's that great because they've been told it's that great. I listen to the Giles Martin ones, and I'm like, well, it's a little bit different than the George Martin, but it's certainly not better. You know what I mean? Because George Martin was a master at his craft. It's like, I feel it's kind of similar to the Marley estate, where the Marley has been doing 40th anniversary remixes, and no one ever said that, like, Exodus sounded bad or Kaya sounded bad. They're essentially just remixing it just to make it sound different. But it sounded perfect the first time around. So it's just kind of a weird – like, yeah, so, yeah, the trumpets are louder now or the bass is quieter. But different doesn't mean better. It just means different and kind of almost dilutes the original thing, if you ask me. So I just think it's tacky and not necessary. And the clear motivation is they just want to make money, which I can't blame someone for making money. But I can because Paul and Yoko and Ringo don't even have enough money by now. Like like – if you want to make money, you can do other things. Like, I don't, you know, it seems to me that perhaps Paul, ever since Paul talked smack on the Stones, I've been mad at him. but it's like, it seems to me that Paul is desperate, and Yoko are desperately trying to keep Beatles as the number one band ever. So they keep tactically reissuing things like every 5 years to make Beatles stay in the conversation, you know. Which I, from a strategy standpoint, is smart, but it seems to me a little desperate. Like, no, people can't forget about the Beatles. You know, meanwhile, like Jimi Hendrix or even Led Zeppelin or Elvis aren't as big as they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, where Beatles kind of still are. And it's because of the business decisions the Beatles have made, but they've kind of been getting there by kind of repackaging things, which I think is a little insulting to the original art. But hey, man. You could always buy the original still, I guess. So,
yeah.
I don't know. It just seems tacky, and it seems like it's all about the cash. All you need is love, they said, but all you need is cash is the answer.
Oh, yeah. Love is green. Love is paper. Love is plastic.
But on the other hand, Em, here's a counter-argument. We should wrap this up, but is a lot of people say they are loving the reissues. I know for a fact Mikey Erg is loving the Beatles reissues. So if people are having fun, who are we to stomp on their party? You know what I mean? So are we being negative Nancys, you know?
I think there's a certain, like, rose-coloredness that you look at something that you have good memories with, and that you'll, like, kind of jump at the chance for something, like, quote-unquote new or something different about it. And I know, like, there would be so many things where I would completely, you know, I don't care if it's just like a random cash grab or whatever, right? Like, this is something that's important. So I do think it's definitely a predatory marketing strategy. I think a lot of brands and bands and companies and whatever use it. And I think that they'll continue to use it because nostalgia has risen in the past, like the need for nostalgia, the urge to have nostalgic things or nostalgic feelings has really increased in the past years. And we see that in a lot of times when there's a lot of turmoil and a lot of, you know, bad stuff going on in the world, like, oh, we'll retreat to something that was good and safe. But again, when you look back, you're looking back through rose-colored glasses. You're not seeing the reality of things. You're seeing how you want them to be or want them to have been. So I think that there's nothing wrong with interacting with it, and there's nothing wrong with like listening to like a Beatles album that makes you happy, or buying the new mix that makes you happy, or whatever. You know, I think that's all well and good, and I think whatever floats your boat, 100%, like not shitting on that at all. But it's just, it's an interesting study, right? When it's your cup of tea, you're like, hell yeah, right? And then when it's not, you're like, oh my gosh. And then you can kind of see the man behind the curtain, so to speak.
Well, there you have it, M, with some wise words. Let's wrap this up real quick.
Yes.
I thought this was hilarious. Everyone else hated it, but I don't care. 10 years ago, Against Me was without a drummer. And I started a petition to have Mikey Erg elected as the new drummer of Against Me. And people were furious in that, like, you can't elect a drummer. That's not an elected position. And I was like, that's the joke. like no one's getting the joke, you know? And
yeah. So
we got, like, thousands of signatures, and we sent in the Laura Jane Grace. And Laura Jane Grace, I wish we did a news article about that, but we didn't, I think. But Laura Jane Grace posted on her Twitter that she got them and she thought it was funny or whatever. And then 10 years go by, and last year Mikey Erg drummed with Laura Jane Grace on one or two songs, The Stone Pony. And I don't know if Mikey drummed with Laura Jane Grace other times or not. I think that might have been the only time Mikey has drummed with Laura in a public setting. And now, 10 years later, Em, the prophecy is fulfilled. Laura Jane Grace is going on tour next year in March.
Yes.
For an entire month, basically. And who's the drummer? Mikey Erg. So, and
finally,
after 10 years, our petition has been granted, and Mikey Erg has been elected as the drummer of Against Me. All the readers hated this, but I don't care. This is hilarious. And what's your stance on the prophecy being fulfilled?
I am very glad the prophecy has been fulfilled. And, you know, it kind of makes you wonder what could be in the works in the future as well. But I'm glad. I think it's good. I think it's fun.
And who's Matt Patton? At first I read it as Mike Patton. I'm like, wow, that's weird. But no, but it's Matt Patton. Who's Matt Patton? Do you know?
Oh, 1 minute. I did read this. I can't remember what band. Oh, there you go. Oh, did it break? Why did it not work? I tried to interact with the thing and it did not respond to me. All right, we will solve this mystery. I'm getting her going now.
Your Matt Patton. Oh, here we go. I think I found it. Drive-By Truckers. Oh, is that him? Drive-By Truckers?
Oh, that sounds right.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah, oh, American cool. Bass player, vocalist. Drive-By Truckers, that makes sense. Okay, yeah, I mean, a lot of people like Drive-By Truckers. I'm not a hater, you know, so anyways,
yeah.
Oh, he was in the Dexateens. I think we covered that back in the day or something. Still don't remember that band for some reason. At any rate, M, will you go see this tour?
They're not coming to Canada.
See, well, you could go to Ohio. How far are you from Ohio, M?
Not. I have no idea. probably a good few hours.
How about Hamden, Connecticut? Let's do a quick search. You're probably closer to Hamden, Connecticut. And where do you live again?
Let's just go with Peterborough.
Peterborough.
Because that'll show up on a map.
Oh, okay, Peterborough in Ontario, Canada. All right.
Yes.
Let's see how. I know people love listening to me Google map questions, but I don't care. Let's do Hamden, Connecticut. Let's see here. Hamden,
Connecticut. Where does it say I am?
That is a 8-hour drive. That's pretty rough. How about New York, New York? That's probably Somerville, Massachusetts. That might be kind of close to you. Let's take a look, and then we'll wrap the show on up. Give me a second here. Somerville, Massachusetts. That is 8 hours again. Oh man!
Holy shit!
How about New York? And you are
7 hours.
8 hours from New York.
Oh, I'm God. 8 hours from everywhere.
And where do you live? Let's see. All right, let's do one
in
more.
The middle of nowhere, actually.
Let's do Columbus, Ohio. If you can't make it there, then it ain't happening. Let's see here. Let's see here. Columbus, Ohio. All right, here we go. And you are
is it less than 8 hours? Are you kidding?
I'm sorry, I mean, it ain't happening.
How am I in the, like, oh my God. Rude.
Well, why don't you try to book the book a show, Em? You should do that. Reach out to Large and Grace and book a show.
I have never booked a show before.
Do it,
I
Em.
will.
Do it.
Hello, can you do it for? I'll give you a pack of Skittles. I have no money.
Well, there you have it. The prophecy is fulfilled.
Yes.
I am very happy about this. I texted
Are you
Mikey
gonna go
Ert.
see?
I am going to go see just to see in the Philadelphia show. I texted
Nice.
Mikey Erg, and he was like, "Ha ha!" I was like, "Oh man!" I was like, "Man, it's been 10 years, dude." But oh well. Listen, at least I enjoy it, and I still enjoy my We Believe in Mikey Erg image from 10 years ago, which was taken from with Batman 2 or whatever. Anyways, and more. I've rambled on quite long enough. Any last words for the listeners? This episode is going to be posted within minutes of the end of recording this. Any last words for the listeners?
Minutes. I need to come up with some like profound wisdom now. I'm drawing a blank. Oh no. All I can think of is just the Wretched Shits would be a really good band name. And that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Well, there you have it. M's new band is the Wretched Shits, and M will be booking a show with Large Jane Grace and Mike Yerg with the Wretched Shits opening
Yes.
between the Hamden, Connecticut, and the New York, New York date. And we will see you next week.